From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Journalism is bad business. This is no other way to put it. Journalism requires people doing investigation. It costs money. It doesn't necessarily generate more profit to pay for journalism. And if it's done well, it's going to piss off people in power.
Rich media, poor democracy. Communication politics in dubious times. And today, a state holiday has been declared in Gujarat, India. What does that have to do with corporate globalization? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Millions of bushels of genetically engineered corn, approved only for animal use, have made their way into the human food supply chain. This according to officials, raising the possibility that the corn will be found in a wide array of foods. Reading from today's front page of the Washington Post, as a result, industry and federal officials are working to find the corn and buy it back before it's made into more taco shells and chips, corn flakes, and other corn products. Although the corn was not approved for humans because of fears it might trigger allergic reactions, officials do not think its presence in food poses an imminent health risk. But the incident raises serious questions about whether genetically engineered products can be kept segregated from conventional ones in the nation's food system. A bill sent to President Clinton would ease the decades-old embargo on Cuba, provide $3.6 billion in aid to farmers, and allow for the import of cheaper prescription drugs. The Senate yesterday approved the $78 billion agricultural spending bill, 86-8. Clinton has agreed to sign the legislation. The bill would allow sales of food to Cuba for the first time in 40 years. The move is largely symbolic because the legislation bars the federal government or U.S. banks from financing the shipments. At the insistence of Cuba's critics in the House, the bill also would prevent Clinton or his successor from easing restrictions on travel to Cuba. The bill also aims to increase sales of food and medicine to Iran, Libya, North Korea, and Sudan by allowing U.S. subsidies for such exports. Anti-globalization campaigners yesterday met organizers of this week's Asia-Europe summit for landmark discussions aimed at avoiding the running street battles which have marked such global conferences recently. This in Seoul, South Korea. There, senior government officials from a number of countries participating in the third Asia-Europe meeting spent nearly an hour in closed-door discussions with the campaigners. The activists at the meeting represent a string of pressure groups, all pushing for the summit to consider more closely the effects of economic globalization on ordinary people. The groups have organized an ASEM People's Forum to run alongside the main summit and plan a major demonstration on Friday, the day the meeting opens. This news from Yugoslavia prospects that President Vojislav Kostunica can form a federal government without Slobodan Milosevic's allies have improved. A Montenegrin party signaled its willingness to form an alliance with the pro-democracy forces. Kostunica is still trying to organize a federal cabinet nearly 2 weeks after he succeeded Milosevic as Yugoslav president. His Democratic Opposition of Serbia coalition is the largest bloc in the 178-seat federal legislature, but lacks a majority needed to win parliamentary approval for a new administration. The United States rebuked South America for failing to support Colombia's planned military offensive against drug producers amid fears that the conflict will spill over the border. In a private meeting yesterday with defense ministers from the region, U.S. Deputy Undersecretary of Defense James Bodner said the U.S.-backed Plan Colombia would go ahead with or without the South American country's support. This news from San Francisco. The California State Supreme Court has declined to review a ruling allowing police to seize vehicles suspected of use in crimes such as drug dealing or soliciting a prostitute, Without comment, a majority of justices yesterday decided not to hear the American Civil Liberties Union's challenge to Oakland's 1997 vehicle seizure law. Under the law, a car can be confiscated even if the crime suspect using the vehicle is acquitted or the car's owner was unaware of the crime. The measure exceeds state and federal standards. The ACLU argued that cities looking to profit from seizures would enact similar measures. The Human Rights Campaign has admonished Texas Governor George W. Bush for continuing to refuse to answer directly whether current federal hate crimes law should cover sexual orientation. Judy Shepard, mother of slain Wyoming college student Matthew Shepard, asked the question again in a new HRC radio advertisement, and officials for the Republican presidential candidate have yet to give a straightforward answer, says the Human Rights Campaign. It reports that Bush's apparent opposition to adding sexual orientation is even more striking in light of the October 15th release of the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports for 1999. As overall serious crime continued to decrease for the eighth consecutive year, hate crimes based on sexual orientation have continued to rise.
How long we gotta wait until we get the keys to the mansion on the hill?
Mansion on the Hill by the A3 here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, you may have seen a glimpse of them in the news, unless you were on one of the marches yourself. But this weekend, thousands of women marched in New York and Washington, D.C. against poverty, and particularly targeted the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Among those people were a group of women from India. Sylvie Pallett is with us, an activist from India with the Friends of Narmada. She's currently in the United States, where she's meeting with the Ogden Corporation. They are intimately involved with the people of India because they are one of those who's moved into India, even as the World Bank has pulled back from supporting from some massive dams because of major protests. This U.S. company that accompanied President Clinton on his trip to India has moved in. Today, we're going to talk about the Women's March, but also more specifically about these major dam projects in India and what they have to do with people in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sylvie Pallett.
Thank you.
So tell us about the march this weekend, why you came all the way from India.
Yeah, there was a group of about 20-25 women from India. And the reason I came was because women from all over the world were getting together to protest against increasing violence against women and poverty. And I work in a struggle that has been raising the issues of how women are being displaced and their lives are being destroyed by corporate globalization and by privatization.
You know, it's interesting, in the past, when you talk about violence against women, you think about domestic violence, or you think about more personal violence. And more we're hearing these issues of globalization being violence against women. But exactly how, when you talk about displacement?
Apart from violence against women in the domestic sector, I think that the state and the corporations also inflict an enormous amount of violence on women's lives. And one of the ways is where I'm working in India, that this corporation Ogden from the U.S., which is a power utility, and a corporation in India are getting together to build a dam which will flood out literally thousands of people, about 60,000 people or so. And there is nothing to restore their livelihoods. This means that women will be on the streets along with the rest of their families, and they will have to bear the brunt of the economic hardship.
Why is today a holiday in this Indian state of Gujarat?
Yesterday, the Supreme Court of India ruled on the other dam, apart from the Maheshwar Dam, which I've just talked about. There are 30 large dams in central India, and the Sardar Sarovar Dam is actually the last of these dams, and it's in Gujarat, which is in western India. And for the last 15 years, the people to be affected by this project and their supporters worldwide have been fighting this dam. They compelled the World Bank to move out of this, and we went to court, to the Supreme Court in 1994. In the final judgment, the Supreme Court has given a go-ahead. There was actually a split judgment. But the majority judgment has allowed the project to go ahead. So in Gujarat, where most of the waters will go, and you know the contractor, politician, nexus will benefit the most, they have declared a state holiday. But in the rest of the area, people are grieving, and people are realigning their forces to fight till the very end.
Yeah, the government's supporting it. Why?
Well, the governments are supporting this project not because of any benefits, because successive droughts in Gujarat have shown that really much smaller water measures are what delivers water, and that large dams have long gestation periods and are never completed. But the problem is that large dams have lots of money, and lots of money means graft. And there's an enormous amount of graft involved between the politicians and the contractors and the dam builders.
In addition to Selvi Palat of Friends of Narmada, one of the major dams in India, Patrick McCulley is on the line with us from Berkeley, California. He is with the International Rivers Network. I mentioned that on President Clinton's trip to India, Ogden officials were a part of that trip, Patrick McCulley. Can you talk about what Ogden is? And we're on Wall Street right now in New York, and I understand they're just down the road.
Yeah, they're a New York-based company that are not very well known here in the U.S. They're not a particularly big company. They're quite a strange company. They have done things that people wouldn't necessarily associate with dams, like Wet n Wild theme parks were owned by Ogden until very recently. The main thing they've done is incinerators, waste-to-energy incinerators, and have received a lot of criticism and a lot of community opposition because of their involvement in incinerators. And they've had other things. Airport catering is a big thing they do. But they're now trying to consolidate, and they're trying to move away from these other less connected activities and to focus on energy. And so they're getting involved with Maheshwar as part of them trying to become Ogden Energy Corp and expanding around the world and taking advantage of the liberalization, privatization that's happening in India and getting involved in some projects there. When they first signed this memorandum of intent during Clinton's visit, we had no idea about this company. They sort of came from nowhere as far as we could see, but they have been involved now since the beginning of the year, and they are saying that they're determined to do this project, and they're saying that it's a good project and that it will be socially, environmentally responsible and so on. And this is, of course, impossible. They're not going to displace 40,000 people or so in India in any sort of socially or environmentally responsible way.
Selvi Palat, you met with Ogden officials, and I should say we invited Ogden to be on the program. At first they said yes, but late last night they left a message saying they would not be on. What did they say to you?
Well, we asked them whether they've signed any more agreements or put in some money after the Clinton visit when they signed up, and they said no. But the question that we really debated was why Ogden is going ahead with this project when there is an international report that came out in June, which says that rehabilitation is simply impossible, that rehabilitation of these thousands of people is almost simply impossible. And if actually rehabilitation is attempted, the financial package will go up so many times that the project will no longer be viable. This report was done by a team that was commissioned by the German government, by the German Development Ministry, which was actually asked for a guarantee for some German loans for this project. And the team was headed by Richard Bissell, who used to be the chairman of the inspection panel of the World Bank and is now a policy director at the National Academy of Sciences. After this report, which sharply indicted the project, the Ogden, instead of withdrawing from the project, has continued to be in the project. And they said that we find this a financially attractive project, but we are continuing to see whether the requirements, financial requirements, will be met. And only after the financial requirements are met, we will assess whether socially this project is possible. And, you know, we basically told them that that is unacceptable to us because corporations are part of civil society. They are embedded in civil society. And they have to play by the rules of civil society. They have to play by, you know, the rules of civilization, which is you can't throw out thousands and thousands of people, you know, or rupture their lives if there is no possibility at all of mitigation.
Well, if they say that the Indian government is working with them, how do you respond?
Well, they did raise this question. They said the Indian government and the state governments are inviting us in. But the question is that the people in the valley and all people who are against and are challenging sort of untrammeled corporatization and globalization understand that human lives are more than private profits. And whether it's Indian governments or state governments, whether it's corporations, we are going to fight them all the way. And we understand that there are links between the governments as well as the corporations, which are based on graft and scandalous deals. For example, in Maheshwar, the power that will be produced by this project will be 5 times more expensive than the power that is currently being produced in India. And this is when electricity rates are going down all over the world. So this is not all about efficiency. It's not about power delivery. It's about making money out of deals, basically bringing darkness to the lives of people's homes. Because if Maheshwar is ever built and power is, you know, comes into the grid, it means that simply thousands and lakhs of people in Madhya Pradesh will have to switch off their lights. So, I mean, both ways, because thousands of people are going to be thrown out of their homes and flooded out, and also lakhs of people will not be able to afford that power. This project is simply not, you know, it's not acceptable.
I think when we hear stories like I read in the news headlines in South Korea, another anti-globalization protest, and now both sides are negotiating to try to make sure that there aren't clashes with police in the street, that the emphasis on the police clashes with protesters often obscure these particular issues that bring people onto the streets. Patrick McCulley, is you're here in the United States with the International Rivers Network. How do you make the connection with people here about why they should care about Sylvie Pallett and people in India?
Well, the clear connection in this case is that we have a U.S. company, and I think we have some responsibility as U.S. citizens to make sure that our companies are responsible overseas and act responsibly, and that there's not double standards whereby they get away with these disgraceful activities overseas that they would never be allowed to get away with in this country. And one other way in which the U.S. is involved is firstly through our government. I mean, this deal between Ogden and the Indian company building the Maheshwar Dam was signed, as you said, as part of Clinton's visit, and there's a picture up on the dam company's website with Commerce Secretary William Daley overseeing the signing of the deal, and the administration plays a big role in facilitating these projects, and the embassy in India has a big role in greasing the skids for these things to happen and encouraging the U.S. investors to get involved and encouraging the Indians to look for the U.S. investors and attract them in. And then another big connection we have is through the World Bank. You mentioned earlier, the U.S., of course, is the largest shareholder in the World Bank. The U.S. Treasury is the dominant power, which says what the World Bank should or should not do. And in the past, the World Bank has been very, very involved in the dams in the Narmada River. And this Sardar Sarovar project downstream of Maheshwar, which you were saying yesterday, the Supreme Court in India very unfortunately gave the go-ahead for more construction of that project. That was a World Bank project. Way back in 1985, they granted $450 million in loans to that project and strongly supported it and gave it a lot of legitimacy within India, so it made it very hard to attack within India because the government there and the authorities would say, oh, but this is a World Bank project, this has the seal of approval, this great institution with all these engineers and experts and economists, therefore it must be a good project. But thankfully, they were kicked out of the project in 1993 because of the years of protests and hunger strikes and marches and so on. They had to get out, so at least we're not having to still contend with them in the project, but now with the whole privatization agenda going on in India, the role of these big government aid agencies has been replaced more often with private companies.
Patrick McCulley, we have to go, but I wanted to ask one last question of Sylvie Pallett, and that is the great writer, Arundhati Roy, who wrote The God of Small Things, which has gotten a tremendous amount of attention, has written a kind of extended essay, which is a small book that people may not have heard about, The Greater Common Good. And it's referring to what the government says in India about the displacement of people. Sylvie Pallett, let's end on this point. They say it's for the greater common good.
That's what they say generally, because every time people who are going to be displaced ask questions, they say this is for the greater common good. But for every specific project, when we ask them specifically to establish the public utility of the project and how it is in the greater common good, they simply cannot do it. And this is what I want to say at the end. And that is that we believe that ordinary people in India, in the river valley of Narmada, and people all over the world have the power to change this destruction, to stop this destruction, whether it emanates from state or federal governments, whether it comes from corporations worldwide, or whether it comes from institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. We know that if we are together and if we receive support from people all over the world, we can stop this destruction.
Well, I didn't see you on ABC, NBC, or CBS being interviewed for why you've come here, not to mention the Women's March as well and that connection with women and violence. When we come back, we're going to hear from Bob McChesney, who has written the book Rich Media and Poor Democracy, and maybe find out why you're not on their guest list. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Sylvie Pallett, activist from India with Friends of Narmada, and Patrick McCulley with the International Rivers Network in Berkeley, California. If people want to get in touch with your group, where do they go on the web, Patrick McCulley?
www.irn.org and also www.narmada.org. That's narmada.org.
Thank you both for being with us. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Well, if Michael Moore were doing this next story, he would probably be taking his camera and a priest and a wedding party to Wall Street to, to throw a wedding for one of the biggest corporate mergers of our time, and that is AOL Online joining with Time Warner. The merger comes as yesterday America Online beat all Wall Street expectations for earnings in its latest quarter, showing strong growth in revenue and subscribers and dispelling fears that the company would be dragged down by a slowdown in online advertising. But this is a marriage of the upper crust. You see, Time Warner, the New York-based media giant, also reported higher than expected third quarter earnings yesterday. The merger of Time Warner and AOL set to close by the end of the fall. These media mergers such as this are becoming more common today in a time when corporate control of the media is at unprecedented levels. We turn now to Robert McChesney, who is one of the foremost experts on issues of media and democracy, a professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy.
The issue I've come to talk about today is of the utmost importance. It's the relationship of media to democracy, the crisis of democracy in the United States today, and the role of the media, the press, in that crisis, and what we can do about it, what we should do about it in the months and years and decades to come. I think if you look at democratic theory, you see that there are really three core elements that are necessary to have a viable political democracy. The first thing is to have a real democracy, a viable democracy, where people actually rule their own lives, is that you can't have a great deal of social inequality. You can't have a democracy if you've got a handful of very wealthy and a mass of very poor. If you think about it, it just won't work. If you've got that much inequality, for a variety of reasons, it'll be very difficult for the poor to ever really participate remotely closely as equals, and then eventually you won't have a democracy anymore. This is not an original concept, I might point out. I can't take credit for that observation. It goes back, in fact, to the very first generation or second generation of democracy coming about in Athens in the 4th century and 5th century BC. Aristotle wrote about this in the Politics. Aristotle said real clearly, democracy can't exist with inequality. You have a choice. You want democracy, you get rid of inequality. If you don't get rid of inequality, you can't have democracy. And that's something that should really be underlined and remembered by those of us who are interested in democracy, how important that is. Because in our current era, the call for not only accepting but glorifying extreme social inequality, as we have in the United States, is extremely powerful and unfortunately rarely countered. And it's something that I think we should immediately and permanently counter. Secondly, a democracy can only work effectively if there's a sense that the well-being of others affect your well-being. There's a sense that there's something in it more than just yourself, that you're in this with other people. There's a community involved. That if everyone around you sinks and you're still sitting on an island, you don't sit there and say, gee, I just won. But you say, gee, there goes my community. My life's terrible. Regrettably, in our current situation, with a very strident free market mentality, we live in an era in which just the opposite is the constant message beat into people's brains. Take care of number one. Put on your blinders. Don't think about the person next to you. Don't think about that person down the road. Don't think about the person in the neighborhood that you no longer have to drive through because you can do everything on the internet. Just think about number one, and if you're happy, everything's fine. In any way, we're told by the pundits, greed is good. Greed is good. Well, that's nonsense. You can't have a democracy in that case. That's a recipe for disaster. This is a point that Adam Smith, the frequently invoked ideologue of the far right, of the free market right today, well understood. One of the things we know about Adam Smith, the British economist who is allegedly the architect of free market policies and eliminating welfare spending, is that the people who invoke his name have never read him. Were they ever to read Adam Smith, they would discover a very different individual from the one who is frequently invoked as the architect of free market policies. In fact, Smith came up with the notion, the invisible hand, to talk about how the market worked, to wrestle with the clear paradox of a capitalist or business-run society. Smith said, he was a moral philosopher, understand, how can a society in which everyone's looking out for number one and is rewarded for being selfish and being greedy be a good society? How can a society in which you don't care about others, you can be rewarded for that and rise to the top, be considered a morally or ethically good society? Of course, this vision of a society, this market society, completely violated all theological precepts that predated it from all religions and all moral philosophy. And that's where Smith came up with the idea of the invisible hand. He said, sure, it looks really goofy. Everyone being completely greedy and taking care of number one produces the best possible outcome and the most happiness for everyone. On the surface, that's a contradiction. But because of the invisible hand of the market working, it produces the optimum social outcome. Everyone being greedy produces a society in which everyone maximizes their happiness. But in fact, it's an absurd scenario. And I think the degree of demoralization and despair in our society is a clear indication of just how bankrupt that view is. And I think Smith never took it seriously. In fact, I know he didn't. And third and finally, if you're going to have a viable democracy, you've got to have an informed citizenry. And now this, once again, is another no-brainer. James Madison, the fourth president, I think, of the United States, late in his career, put it well, and I'll paraphrase this quote. He said, a popular democracy without a press system that informs and engages people as a prelude to a tragedy or a farce or both. If you don't have, if people can't have access to be informed on affairs of the day, generate opinions, have a clear reckoning and accounting for the people in power and the people who want to be in power, the right to vote, the right to be a citizen, doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot. It's mandatory to have that, to have a viable democracy. Now, I think quite clearly this third element, media, is central to democracy. But I would also argue not only is it central to number three, but it's also implicated in both of the first two. And our current media system, in my view, regrettably, is working against democracy on all three of those counts, particularly number three. Now, having said that, I want to underline one point. I don't think the media are the primary cause of the problems we face, or the only cause. I think they're one of the causes, and an important cause. But the process of democratizing our society does not come exclusively through changing the media, because that alone won't do it. But the process of changing the media has to be part of any program to rejuvenate democracy in this country, and probably in most any other country that enjoys the sort of system we have in the United States today. Now, I guess before I move on to the media, one last point. Let's clear up a myth. There's a myth going around that we live in a democracy here. You're probably familiar with that one. Lots of students I asked today, they all agreed, yes, this is a democracy. And I asked, you know, why is this a democracy? What are the criteria by which the United States is a democracy today? And I think the sort of reason is, the classical reason, the rule of the many. Is this a democracy because the people of this country make the fundamental, important social and political decisions? Well, no one thought that was the case, because clearly the many don't make any of those decisions. They have very little say over most important decisions. In this country, a significant percentage of important decisions are made by corporations in the private sector, completely unaccountable to the public. And those that are made in the public sector are generally made behind closed doors with minimal public participation. So what exactly is the degree of why are we a democracy in this country? Well, it generally comes down to two things. One, you have a right to do what I'm doing here, get up and blow off steam and bellyache and whine and say whatever you want without being thrown in the hoosegow. And I think that's a wonderful right, and I'll fight for our right to do that. But that's not democracy. Democracy is the rule of the many. Democracy is actual power in the hands of people who live in a country. It's not just the right to stand up and complain about the fact you don't have any power. Democracy means really having power. And the second factor is that you can vote. Okay, we don't really know what they're doing. Okay, we don't really have any control over what we're doing. But at least every 2 or 4 years, we can vote them out if we don't like their commercials. So we're a democracy. That seems to be the logic here. And if that is the logic, that's what our tenuous reed is that makes us a democracy. We have the formal right to vote out people or vote in new people. I think it tells us just how far we are from any sort of meaningful democracy. I don't think any of you need to have me catalog the deplorable nature of electoral politics in the United States today. The current system we have is simply not working, or at least it's not working very well. There are exceptions, of course, but in general, the exceptions are few. Now, the fight for democracy has been going on for a long time. It didn't just start 6 months or a year ago. It began back in Greece. And the core fight for democracy historically, until this century, the leading fight for proponents of democracy was always to extend the franchise to an ever-increasing part of the adult population. That was the main democratic battle until this century. Back in the time of Greece and Athens and the other Greek democratic city-states, the battle over who got to be a citizen and who didn't was a central battle. The more the citizenship franchise was extended into the adult population, the more poor people had power, the more that it was a threat to those with wealth and power, and the more they fought it. And it was a key fight of that period. It has been a major fight in U.S. history. For those of you who have studied American history, you're well aware, I assume, that at the time of the American Revolution, in the early constitutional period, a fundamental fight was over what sort of democracy we would have in this country. It's a fight that in many respects is being fought out to this day still. On one side, you had Thomas Paine and Ben Franklin, who believed in universal adult male suffrage, and adult suffrage in some cases, and believed in a democracy of the many, with the power of a single legislative body with maximum power to the voters. On the other side, you had people like John Adams, the second president, John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who were opposed to democracy. who were opposed to popular rule, who wanted to work hard to see that a system be set up to minimize the possibility that the many could overrule the interests of the few. Both Adams and Jay counted among their very favorite expressions the saying, those who own the country ought to govern it. And both of them worked assiduously to see the franchise restricted as much as possible. Now, the battle for universal suffrage was fought throughout the 19th century, and by the 20th century, it began to turn the tide, and we had largely universal adult suffrage by the 1920s, with the exception of the U.S. South, which finally came along in about late 1960s. But we see in the 20th century, the struggle for democracy takes a turn. On one hand, you have universal suffrage, granted, but the voting rates then begin to decline. And then the fight between Democrats and anti-Democrats takes a different turn. It's no longer over the right to vote. That fight has been won, but it's whether the right to vote will mean anything, whether the right to vote should have any content. And that fight right now, the anti-Democrats are winning considerably. The low voter turnout, I submit, is not an accident, a fluke, just sort of a bad hair day for the voters. The low voter turnout responds to long-term strong pressure by those who wish very much to minimize the possibility of democracy in this nation as in others. Public relations, the industry of public relations, is clearly a result of the rise of universal suffrage, and it's how powerful moneyed interests dealt with the fact that they had to deal with universal suffrage and the threat that the many could outvote the few and might exercise their interest. As Alex Carey, the Australian, put it, there are three great developments in the 20th century. One, the rise of universal adult suffrage. Second, the rise of the corporation to dominate the political economy of societies. And third, the rise of public relations to protect corporations from universal suffrage. The rise of public relations publicity to take the risk out of democracy, to limit the ability of democracy to actually be democracy. And this is done through any number of mechanisms, but the most brilliant way it can be done is to produce a general populace that's demoralized, depoliticized, and rather than having to be oppressed, simply doesn't get involved at all. Exactly what we see in the United States. I think probably the most depoliticized society in the world, with the exception formerly of Russia. I don't know what's going on there now, but under the communists, the Soviet society was fairly depoliticized as well. But we're clearly a tyrant's envy for our degree of depoliticization. And it's worth noting, as I said, this isn't an accident. Around the world, as the free market policies are spread, and the term for this globally is called neoliberalism, the idea of getting rid of labor unions, limiting their power, getting rid of social spending that might have helped poor people and working class people, as opposed to the other subsidies never talked about that go to powerful interests. The idea of lowering taxes and regulations on wealthy people and on business, these sets of policies that are called neoliberalism, that the Reagan-Thatcher revolution, that are being adopted increasingly around the world, it's not just an economic model, it's a political model. This model of capitalism, neoliberalism, depends on having a neoliberal political culture, exactly like we have today. Ours is the model of what a neoliberal political culture is. It's a culture where politics is downplayed, consumption is emphasized, and the media is crucial to the development of this type of model, and I'll go into that in a second. And one example of this is quite interesting is the country of Chile, the nation of Chile, which prior to 1973 was considered arguably the most vibrant political culture in the world, certainly in the third world. If you were to go to Santiago, Chile, prior to 1973, you would see literally 10, 12, 15 daily newspapers in the capital city of Santiago. The voter turnout rate was the highest in the world. It was the sort of country where you could talk to anyone in the street about politics and have a conversation that would make a college professor blush in the United States today. It was a highly politicized society. In 1970, they had the temerity to elect a socialist president. And then 23 years later, the Chilean military overthrew that elected government. I guess there's no more time for democracy there, and installed one of the most brutal dictatorships of the century in that country. But during that dictatorship, while they were clearing out the Democrats, can't have that because the wrong side won, they crafted a new constitution that was to go into effect when they did make their return to democracy, after it was safe, once they were sure that the bad guys couldn't possibly win. Then you can have democracy again. And the new constitution was drafted by a gentleman named Jose Guzman, and a friend of mine who's a Chilean scholar translated portions of it for me in the correspondence that led up to the Chilean constitution. And what they decided was, they said, what's the ideal sort of political culture for a market economy? And they said, the United States really has it right. You need to have a healthy democracy in a market economy. What you have to have is a situation where both political parties basically agree on everything. You have to have a situation where whoever wins, they can't affect the balance of power in society. The economic institutions are untouched. And they said, you know, it's really not a bad thing if people don't vote. That's actually a really good thing. So high voter absenteeism and lack of interest is really a healthy phenomenon. That was the argument Guzman made. So let's try to construct, you know, this stuff with 95% voter turnout, 12 daily newspapers, people really interested in issues. You know, that's for the birds. You know, that's good for civics class, but that's not going to cut it in the real world. That led to Allende last time. We've got to get rid of that stuff. So now we have Chile returned to democracy in its tepid new model in 10 years ago now, almost, 9 years ago. Voter turnout has plummeted in the last Chilean election. I don't know the exact figure. My Chilean friend told me this. An astounding number of people left their ballots blank upon voting, 10-20%. The culture has been largely depoliticized. The shop till you drop, me first mentality overwhelming the middle class. Neoliberal political democracy has won.
Robert McChesney is author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics in Dubious Times. He is professor of media studies at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with McChesney in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the speech of Robert McChesney, author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics in Dubious Times.
Neoliberal political democracy has won, or seems to have won. And that's the sort of culture that goes well with the sort of economy we have now. And as I think it's clear from my comments, this type of neoliberal democracy, quote-unquote democracy, this type of neoliberal policies of unbridled market capitalism goes directly against what you need if you're going to have a viable democracy. And the sort of political culture we have in this country today is not an accident, it's not a mistake, it's exactly what's appropriate for the type of economy we have. This is it. Get used to it or change it. And if you're going to change it, you're probably going to have to change our economy or some aspect of it to have any hope of long-term success. Now, the media, as I've said, are strongly implicated in the neoliberal democratic culture. And the media, of course, occupies all of our attention. A recent survey I saw said that I think the average American now consumes 11 and a half hours of media a day. All-time high, you'll be glad to know. Hey, who says, you know, we aren't number one? And we're in the midst of stunning changes in our media culture, as I'm sure you're all aware. To some extent, these are technological changes due to digital communication, the expansion of channels, the rise of the internet, satellite, and cable. And to a large extent, less talked about, the changes in our media culture today are a result of market economics and also neoliberal policies, which have promoted economic concentration and commercialization of media, which I'm going to talk about in a second. In particular, a law passed in 1996, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which completely revamped the basis of regulation for radio, television, electronic communication, telephony, data, the internet, is central, this law, to what's going to come in the next generation or two. It's generally considered one of the two or three most important laws of the decade, one of the seminal laws of the last 20 or 25 years. The law replaced the Communications Act of 1934, was responsible for the development of radio and television, and it was in power for 62 years to give some sense of how significant these laws are. Well, the Telecommunications Act of 1996, befitting a neoliberal democracy, was passed in a manner that would probably have embarrassed Mobutu or Suharto. The law was received almost no press coverage whatsoever. It was undebated in Congress. It was covered extensively in the business and trade press, where it was covered as an issue of importance to investors, and to shareholders, to managers, but never covered anywhere as an interest of as an issue of importance to citizens, to people, the media system that will dominate and rule for the coming generations. The basic premise of the law was that whoever can make the most money should win. Notions of public service, that there is something that should be exacted from private media operators that use the public airwaves, were minimized with the idea that competition, we were told, would lead to the optimum results and produce the best of all possible worlds for all of us. We were told the Telecommunications Act of 1996 would lead to vast new entrants into all the communication markets, improving quality, lowering prices. Of course, this was silly. If it was going to do anything like that, the firms that pushed it through would have never let it get passed. They're not stupid. The law was basically written by and for a handful of dominant firms with massive lobbyists. And there were tremendous fights over this bill. The fights were between the cable companies and the satellite companies and the telephone long distance and the telephone local over who's going to get the best deal, who's going to get the biggest slice of the pie. Conspicuously not represented at the table then or now is the public interest. What do we get? There we're told that competition will serve us as they allegedly compete for our services. And I think we've seen the degree of competition so far that this bill has brought. It's led to the largest and most massive wave of mergers and consolidation in media and telecommunications in the history of humanity, whatever you want to call it, history, period, in this country or any other. And I'll get back to this a little bit later, some of the implications of this, because it's quite an astonishing piece of legislation that was, as I said, completely undebated in Congress. And the public, most people in the public are not even aware it passed. So what we have seen in the United States this decade is, as a result of market economics, deregulation, or technology, a stunning reformation and transformation of the media system in the United States and globally. During this decade, we've seen rapidly emerge a first tier of 7, 8, 9 firms that thoroughly dominate our media system. There's another tier of maybe 10 to 12 firms that round out the system. But once you get past these first 20 or 22 firms, you've basically got people who publish most of the books, most of the magazines, most of the newspapers, own almost all the cable channels, cable systems, film studios, record companies, book publishing companies, billboard companies, radio stations, TV stations, internet portals, soon to be, in the business. It's a small group of people. And it is a fairly dramatic change. We've always had a commercial media system, for example, and in the 1940s and 1950s, this is a highly concentrated industry. So that if you were to come to look at the United States media in 1960 or 1950, all of the major media sectors, magazine publishing, book publishing, radio, television, broadcasting, films, music, each of these were dominated by a relative handful of firms, 2 or 3 at the low end, up to 10 or 12 at the high end. But they tended to be firms in different industries. What's happened since the 1980s is the number of firms in each of these industries has shrunk a little bit, but more importantly what's happened is that the dominant firms are now major players in each of these sectors, or in many of these sectors. The largest firms have become conglomerates. So in 1983, when Ben Bagdikian wrote the first version of his seminal work, The Media Monopoly, he talks about 50 firms that dominated all of mass media. In the 5 editions of the book he's published since then, he's got it down to 10 now, thanks to mergers and acquisitions. And the top tier of firms now that really dominates our media system are massive firms 10 or 15 times larger than they were just a decade ago due to mergers and acquisitions and internal growth, vastly larger and more powerful and influential than they ever were before. Well, who are these guys? This is a very abstract talk. Let's put some meat on these bones. The largest media firm in the world is Time Warner. It'll do $28 billion of business this year. Then comes Disney. It'll do $25 billion of business this year. Then, in roughly in the right order, Viacom, and probably many of you haven't heard of Viacom because it's really not a trade name, but they own Nickelodeon, MTV, Simon & Schuster, Blockbuster, Showtime, Paramount Film Studios, a lot of other stuff too, but that's their primary stuff. Let's see, TCI, the cable company, is in the process of being bought by AT&T. Sony, the huge Japanese conglomerate electronics manufacturer, which owns Columbia and TriStar Films and has major music interests. General Electric, the largest, the most lucrative firm in the world, which owns NBC. Seagram, the Canadian drinks manufacturer, which owns Universal Studios and which just recently bought PolyGram for their music interests. And then finally, you could probably put in CBS, massive television and radio interests. But that's really the first tier of American firms. And as I said, there's a second tier, which includes most of the large newspaper chains and some of the cable companies, a handful of other firms. Now, why have they done this? Why have firms gone from, why did we have to leave the good old days of, you know, firms dominating one particular sector but not trying to be in others? Well, the reason is really pretty simple. What these firms have learned is that the profit hole when you own a bunch of, or a major player in a bunch of different sectors, is vastly greater than the sum of the profit parts. When you're a media conglomerate, if you play your cards right, and it doesn't always work, you're in a position where you can make a lot more money than if you just are a player in one sector. And the logic of this is such in the market that firms that only have holdings in book publishing or music or television can't really compete with their competitors who have those things plus other things. You got to be a player in everything, or you really have to get out. I'll give you an example of what one firm owns, the largest firm, to give a sense of what a modern media conglomerate tries to look like. Take Time Warner. Time Warner is one of the major film studios of the world. It owns Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema. It also is one of the biggest movie theater-owning companies in the world, although most of its theaters are outside the United States. It's the largest cable system company in the United States, Cable Systems, and it's also the largest cable TV channel company. Its cable TV channels include HBO, CNN, all the CNN stations, the Turner stations, TBS, TNT, Court TV, a bunch of other things. It's one of the largest book publishing companies in the world. It's the largest magazine publishing company in the United States. It's one of the three largest music companies, Warner, Elektra, Atlantic Records, in the world. It has retail stores. It has amusement parks. And I'm leaving something out, I'm sure, that's worth billions of dollars, and I apologize for that. Trust me, they're doing fine. What can you do with all this sort of property? What advantages does this give a company like Time Warner? Well, let's take Disney for a second, and I'll give the most extreme example, but I think this really applies across the board. And that is the film The Lion King. I'm sure many of you saw that film. It was a Disney animated film made in 1994. The Lion King was a smash hit. It generated approximately, I think, $700 million in global box office, which is really a lot of money for a film. I mean, it puts it in the top five of all time. It might have even been number one before Titanic, I'm not sure, but it's way up there. So it's a lucrative film. Now, Disney gets to keep about half of that. The rest goes to the movie theater owners. So Disney gets maybe $350 million for Titanic, or excuse me, Lion King. Well, how much profit does Disney make in Lion King, do you think? Well, they made over $1 billion in profit, not just revenue, but profit. How do you get $1 billion of profit out of $350 million of revenue? That's good math. Well, look at what else Disney owns, and you can see where the money is. Disney also owns, besides having a film studio, it owns ABC and the Disney Channel. So it can create TV shows, spin-offs based on The Lion King. It also has book publishing and CD-ROM and comic book publishing interests, so it can publish all sorts of Lion King-related books and CD-ROMs. It has music, so it can do Lion King CDs. And it has amusement parks, so you can go to Disney World, Euro Disney, Disneyland, Disney Japan, and see Lion King rides and other accoutrements. And then, of course, there are 600 Disney stores gracing the malls of America and the world, you'll be glad to know. And in all of those stores, there's a heavy dose of Lion King merchandise and paraphernalia to be sold. In short, there's a lot of money to be made from a successful cash cow film. It also means, in the case of Disney, that when they make a film that's only mediocre at the box office, like their three subsequent animated films, Pocahontas, Hunchback of Notre Dame, and Hercules, all of which did about $200 million globally and $100 million in the United States, each of those films generated over $500 million in profit. Using the same revenue streams I've talked about for Lion King. Well, if you think about the logic there, if you're making animated films and you want to compete with Disney, if you don't have all their other revenue streams, you've got a lot more risk facing you than Disney has. If you make a film that bombs at the box office and that's your only source of income, you're in big trouble. You might be out of business. Disney makes one that bombs at the box office, it can still make a profit. And so it is that the only competitors in the film animated films market are those connected to the four largest media firms. Time Warner has their Warner Brothers Studios, Viacom has Nickelodeon, Fox has their Fox Family Channel, and they did Anastasia and other ones. And DreamWorks is trying to get in on it too, and that's sort of a different story, but they're following the same recipe. But at any rate, that's the only people who can compete. Now, that same logic doesn't apply to everything in the media. That's an extreme case, but it's not unlike the rest of the media as well. In short, it's an extremely uncompetitive system we have. It's getting less and less competitive. It's closely linked to advertising and serving advertisers. And just this, the degree of ownership and concentration, having 8 or 10 firms dominate it, doesn't really convey exactly how non-competitive the system is. And this, of course, is one of the great myths of capitalism. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard this myth that our economy is based on competition. Has anyone heard that one? I get a kick out of that one. Isn't that great? Boy, what are they going to tell us next? To build a skyscraper on some seaweed. Our economy is based, that's the sort of stuff we're supposed to swallow, that the economy is based in competition. In fact, to those who run the economy, the smart ones, the ones who succeed, their success is based on eliminating competition or any possibility of competition. No sane or rational capitalist or investor wants competition. You want it for all your competitors in other markets, maybe, but for you, none. You do everything in your power to eliminate it. And Rupert Murdoch, the patron saint of media giants, put it best. He said, when I'm thinking of going into a new market, my competitors and I, we can go in and kill each other and then make a deal, or we can make a deal first. And Rupert's no dummy. He makes the deal first. So it is that of the 9 largest media firms in the United States that I talked about, they each average having an equity joint venture where they share ownership in a project with 6 of the other 8. They average that. Murdoch has at least one with all of them. He's in bed with all of them. And that's just good business. You reduce risk, you reduce competition, you increase your chance of profit. That's how the system works. It's a very non-competitive system. But we shouldn't be just concerned with the economics of it, and I could go into much more detail on the economics. I'll stop there. Let's just talk for a second about the implications of this hyper-commercial concentrated system. First and foremost, the fundamental problem with our media system is it's set up to serve investors, and secondly, advertisers, not citizens. And that's a real problem, because we need a media system that is going to serve citizens, maybe not exclusively, but largely, certainly much more largely, in a much larger fashion they're getting at present. People often talk, and many people I've spoken to today have said, well, what about all the diversity? Oh, look, you've got 40 cable channels. It used to be you only had 3 or 4 channels. So, isn't that better? Well, yeah, of course, I guess it's better. But look closely at what's on those channels. And basically, of the 50 largest cable channels in the U.S. today, the first-tier companies I just mentioned, plus 1 or 2 others, own all of them, outright or partially.
Robert McChesney is author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy, Communication Politics in Dubious Times. This as the corporate merger of Time Warner and AOL looks like it will be wrapped up by the end of the fall. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sid Rack Franklin with deep appreciation. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!